Welcome to Get to Work Hurley, your podcast for pro writers, fans, and geeks of all sorts. On this episode, she's a consulting futurist and science fiction writer based in Toronto. She's the author of the Machine Dynasty series, Company Town, and contributor to How to Future, Leading and Sense-Making in an Age of Paper Change. Her work has appeared in Boing Boing, Slate, MIT Technology Review, Wired, The Atlantic, and elsewhere. And her latest novel, Glass Houses, was published August of 2024 by Tor. Welcome to the podcast, Madeline Ashby. And now your host, Cameron Hurley.
Madeline, it has been a long time since
I've... Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, go ahead.
I had to write a book so I could hang out with people again.
This futurist, you're going and talking to people all the time. So.
Well, I mean, like I was, and then pandemic happened, and I did some work for WHO, and nothing will apprise you of the seriousness of it more so than that. And so I didn't go anywhere. For a long time.
Long time.
Many years.
Oh my God, girl. No, I'll tell you, I read Glass Houses, and it was, and for Patreon backers, we'll have the video, but this is the beautiful book, Glass Houses. And it was like, you were literally at all these tech conferences taking notes. I said, I was like, this is all real shit. Like, this is all, you don't make this shit up. She went to a conference and it's every single line was just devastating. Just devastating.
I've heard that from other women in tech. It was really funny because the book came out in August and we did everything around it. Like I was very lucky. I was very fortunate. Like they really promoted the book. Like I went places, we talked about it, like met people, like, you know, fun stuff like that. It was great. And but in a weird way, like it wasn't real to me until relatively recently, like in the past month or two, like someone on Blue Sky got in touch and like they sort of tagged me and they talked about reading it. And it was a woman in tech. She had left tech like a year or two ago. And she said that it was like I had been sitting next to her or something like that. And I cried for like a solid 10 minutes.
100%. Yep.
Like it was, the thing I had set out to do for people in that situation had finally happened. And so it was like, oh, now it's real, I guess.
Yeah. Well, you had the reader. You hit your ideal audience.
It did the thing, and like not only had they found it, but that it had done the thing that I had hoped it would do for them, because it would be a different thing if they had found it and they were like, what is she talking, like what does she know, this is wrong, all of it is wrong. You know.
Yeah, totally. So where, and I know I read the acknowledgments, I'll tell you, I read the acknowledgments of the book and felt every word because of the shit that I think a lot of us have been through. This one took a while to marinate. Do you want to talk a little bit about, that process of marination and like when you started, when you knew it was ready, like all the things that kind of, and I know that's a big ask, but kind of that narrative ideation process.
I mean, I'm not sure I ever knew that it was ready. I think that, I had the idea probably around the time that I had the Company Town idea. Like, I think around the time that I was writing Company Town, I had that idea. Probably around the time that I was doing a lot of consulting, I was sort of in and out of, you know, part of my job is sort of parachuting into places and listening to people talk about their problems or at least the problems within the company. I say that like it's their personal problems, but like inevitably those two mesh, like, who you are at home as a communicator is also who you are at work as a communicator. And like, that's where a lot of those issues stem from. So inevitably I would be parachuted into these places and I would be treated in a very privileged way. I would be quite insulated from the everyday politics and sniping, backbiting, you know, undermining, stuff like that, because I'm not there for very long. I'm Mary Poppins, right? You know, I'm just there. I go when the wind changes. But there were other women who were there every day. And I could see I could imagine what it would be like to be there every day as them. So in a lot of ways, the book is about why I don't have that life. It is, you know, I think there's been a lot of talk about like auto fiction and, you know, that kind of thing. And is this about you, or is this a thinly veiled, like that kind of thing? And like, no, this is about why I didn't do that. This is about the life that I didn't have, which I think is equally as valid a subject for fiction for everybody. And indeed, one of the things it's supposed to do is give you that sort of sliding doors moment of what could have happened. And I had the idea, and it was like years ago, almost probably even 10 years ago, I had the idea. And it went from like kind of a survivor Lord of the Flies kind of thing. The book is about a troop of or like the first 15 employees of a startup that is based in Toronto but is run by a Californian. The CEO and the CEO and co-founders are both Californian or both American, and they the company gets acquired, and they take a celebratory trip. The plane is quite literally on autopilot, it's self-piloting, and they are forced to make an emergency landing on a small island. And that small island is only populated by one building, and that one building is a giant black glass cube. And at first, it is very hard to get in, and then it is very hard to get out. And
there was no subtext at all in this novel. It was literal text.
None.
It was all literal text.
Right there. Right there. You know. What does Garth Marenghi say? It's subtleties for cowards. Or something. Something like that, like, or subtext. I think it's subtext. It's like subtext. Some writers say they use subtext. They're cowards. Anyway, so I had initially kind of thought like, oh, it's gonna be initially like the house was not even part of it. I thought like, oh, what would be so fun is to like have all these very high tech like gestural computing, you know, invisible interface, you know, kinds of folks have to deal with like wood. And stuff. And that was very charming for a while. And then they all got into wood. Like they all got into like, you know, starving themselves and like hiding out in hot springs and like building things out of yurts or whatever. And I was like, okay, no, like that's sure. No. And then it was going to be about a few other things. And in fact, my editor, Miriam Weinberg, like at Tor said, every time you turn in a draft of this, it's a different genre. You know, it's a science fiction novel, it's a horror novel, it's a spy novel, it's a corporate espionage, like kind of a Michael Crichton-y thriller kind of thing, like, or it's a romance novel, or it's like, you know, or there's more sex than there was, or like blah blah blah. And finally, I think the big shift was 2018 in writing it, in that one, I got on better drugs, or got on drugs, and they were legal
I
drugs.
Feel that. I feel that. Yeah.
But they were better drugs, and I started to parts of my brain that kind of like hadn't been active before sort of started turning on. Like I started having ideas in different genres that I hadn't had before. It was sort of like somebody was walking around my brain, flipping on lights and turning on the water, much like testing out a new apartment. Like when you try to figure out if everything works. So that started happening. So that was good. At the same time, I was writing on Realm Media's Orphan Black, the Next Chapter project with Malk Older and Helly Kennedy and a bunch of others. And that taught me sort of those story breaking techniques, which had never really been part of my repertoire before. I'd been very intuitive and pants-like and kind of, you know, I didn't like the idea of having everything laid out. And then when you have to do that with other people, you realize that like the function of the to-do list, like the, or the function of the outline is that essentially it's a to-do list. And the function of setting it out ahead of time is that you are making a contract with your collaborators for what you will be responsible for, information-wise, task-wise, word count-wise, like all that jazz. And so having that experience sort of taught me to be less afraid of just writing the list. Like once I realized that it was just a list, then it was a lot simpler. That it was not, in fact, like cast in stone or anything like that. It's a list. People make lists all the time.
And I'll say it is. I mean, you can feel it, right? Having read some of your other work, right? I know.
Yes, where I went, I feel it most of all.
Up. Yeah, for Matt, like it was huge level up, and I have a lot of sympathy for writing thrillers and stuff because you have to control the information, and when the reader gets the information, has to line up with when the character gets the information. So yeah, I was curious about that. Yeah, the story
that was also really influenced by the Orphan Black process, because I wrote on two seasons of that, and Orphan Black is like notoriously kind of like thorny and complex and like very convoluted, and like you're constant new information, and we sort of bore that out with the audio drama. And when you're sitting in a room like a writer's room, because it operates on a writer's room, you know, 4212, like card sort, you make the pitch gets accepted or not, blah blah, that model, it is like suddenly having a group of readers around you too. Like the function of the writer's room is in a lot of ways is to get the collective intelligence of all of the readers. It's not all the writers, it's all the readers as well, because every writer in that room is also a reader, and they are hearing your ideas, and they're hearing them as a reader as well, or as a listener in this case, I guess. And so we suddenly, like, it gave me an insight into, oh, this is what this sounds like on the other side. This is what I sound like when I say this, or something like that. And suddenly I started to really think in terms of what does the audience know and when do they know it? And I started to think of it at the same time. I also, for other reasons, I was learning a lot about plain language writing, and like a friend of mine was working on a project where she was converting a lot of the documents at her workplace into federally mandated plain writing act, like stuff that had to be compliant with the plain writing act. And so she had asked me about it, and I looked into it, and it had never occurred to me that writing was a design affordance, which was dumb. I should have thought of that. Like, I felt immediately very gobsmacked that I had not really considered that before. But once I saw it, I couldn't unsee it. And then suddenly it, like, everything got a lot clearer. And that was when I started to actively cut out of the book. Like, and sadly, the truly humbling experience was that every time I cut the book, it got better. Like, no one likes the, like, you know what this book needs? Less of you. Like, no one is super into hearing that, I don't think. You gotta be a real special kind of masochist before that's your thing.
Isn't it about, and I think I look at it as, you know, you are finding out what the book essentially is about, right? Like, that to me is that process.
What is this about?
It's that statue. I'm shaving away all the marble that is not this thing that I'm trying to say.
Yeah, there's an old theory I subscribe to about interpreting a dream, which is describe the dream in the amount of text that you have for a fortune cookie, and that's the meaning of the dream. Like, can you put it on like a tweet length or a skeet length or whatever? Yeah. Like, would it fit on a fortune cookie? If you had to only fit it there, that would be the meaning of the dream. And I really think that in a lot of ways, like an elevator pitch or like a high level concept or like whatever, is kind of the same way. Like, what is this about? Like, no, tell your story walking. Like, tell me what is happening here. Not what it means to you, not how you feel about it, not why you're doing it, not what inspired you about it, not da da da. Those are all things between you and the book. The book and the reader is actually the primary relationship. Mm-hmm. Like, what's hard about publishing a book, and I think, like, people, until it's happened, you almost don't, you can't know, but there's a moment where, like, your relationship to that text becomes less important than its relationship to everybody else. You literally sort of send it out into the world, and that's it.
I'm just going to make that note here.
Well, you're, because your relationship to it will always be there. Right? I mean, barring something like a very tragic thing, like a Salman Rushdie moment or something like that, or like barring something that is like apocalyptic in nature, right? The you will always have that, and you will always have seen all the other drafts of it. You will always know its lineage in a way that the reader doesn't. But that's the one that lives with them.
You're blowing my mind, because I just finished a real very personal book, right, that made me cry.
Oh,
I did the whole
wonderful.
thing. Yeah, and it was great,
Yes,
right?
that's
And I
fantastic.
can feel also in this book some catharsis for you as well, right? So it is interesting, because
Oh, yeah.
I do have to get to the point. And I'm curious how your relationship went with your editor getting to that
Oh.
point, because it sounds like you guys worked on this for a while back
We
and
worked on
forth.
it for a very long time. Like,
Yeah.
she was extraordinarily patient with me. Everyone was extraordinarily patient with me, like above and beyond what I deserve. But Miriam had a lot of faith in that. I think, you know, she understood that a lot of my outside novel work life, like a lot of the Foresight work that I do and whatever, was feeding this. Like, she understood it in a way that I think a lot of people did not. She understood that this was all grist for the mill and was all research, and that it was also building a brand, that it was that those two things were going to go together, you know, that you couldn't have the one without the other. Like, she understood that, like, very quickly, I think. And at first she would like want more, and like I think she just knew that it wasn't ready, and like I would finish it and she's like, no, it's still not done, like it's not ready. And then we got it to a point where she's like, I think this is it. There's still some things I would change or whatever, but I think this is the workable one. This is the one that like we can actually,
This is
you
the
know,
one we
like
can actually work
this
with.
is the one. Yeah, no, it's like she, like as opposed to just reading it, this is the one. Like, this is the one that I think gives us the most opportunities, or something like that. And I forget how she phrased it, but the language we both landed on, or the language that I landed on, was like, oh, okay, what we're gonna do is we're gonna find it in the edit, which is film language. And I mentioned to Miriam the very now very famous Thelma Schoonmaker or Schoonmaker quote about her lifelong collaborator Martin Scorsese, because she's been his editor since he was a student. And she says something like, well, Marty's films aren't violent until I make them violent. And it's like, that's the role. Like, that is the key. And so there's probably a whole other book of deleted material that like never made it in. All of which was just complication. All of which was like stuff that wasn't that it wasn't interesting, but it altered the timing. And I think what we forget in editing text is that text unfolds at a speed in much the same way that music and film do. There is a cadence to those words. Those words take time. Reading takes time. For different people, it takes different amounts of time. But your job is to make sure that those things play out evenly for them, regardless of where they have left off. And you should be sort of, you are creating an experience. Like, I get to work with a lot of experienced designers and people who think about that all the time. And so now I kind of think about like, okay, what am I doing to this person as they are reading? Like, literally, what hormones are flooding their body when they are reading this? And how am I steering and navigating and guiding and directing that experience for them, as opposed to just telling them something, I guess. And that's where we, and then it went, once I realized that, it became a lot clearer. And also the other book that I read that was so, so helpful, and I think I mentioned it in the acknowledgments, and if I don't, I'm going to be very angry with myself, is Plotting and Writing Suspense Fiction by Highsmith.
them.
And yeah. I think yeah. you I might see. Also, you may even have reverted to me. I
maybe, yeah, I do. I have it, yeah.
Because I probably saw you talking about it somewhere, and I read that, and my God, is that a good book? Mm-hmm. And it's right. and you
it's
know,
little. Like,
it's yeah. thin. It's real tiny. Little. It's yeah. tiny because she does not waste a single word. She does like she is out there, you know, living her life, or was out there living her life in Paris, and was like, write more, screw you, like you know. So, and I think that's also like a thing about American letters generally. Like American writing is, you know, when we think about the most formative literature in our canon, it's like short. Uh-huh. Great Gatsby is a very thin book.
So. Yeah, I mean, and you're writing sure you get a typewriter, right? And you get
it was a physically embodied act. It was like, I have to carry this big machine, I have to sit at this thing, there's no ergo desk chair, whatever, it's me and this and a stack of paper that I have to maintain control of and hopefully not lose Hemingway style on a train somewhere.
And it does, and I know that's a big conversation about how word processing, especially, it has encouraged us to vomit, to word vomit, and to word vomit, word vomit, word vomit, which is great, but you've got to know how to edit it out, right? To your point, mm-hmm. I've heard that great stuff about Miriam, that she's just an absolute joy to work with. She's like a true editor.
So the funny story about our editing this book is that like we got it into shape again. And then on the way to her American Thanksgiving, I live in Canada, so I don't do American Thanksgiving. It's just another excuse to eat pie, which is great, but I don't do American Thanksgiving. We have it in October, like civilized people, before the weather is bad, when all the harvest is in, but before the weather is bad, like you should. She was on her way somewhere, her husband was driving, and she had the manuscript in her lap, on her laptop, and was on the phone with me. And we were both in the same like Word document, not online, but she was like, on page this, do on page X, do Y. Or whatever. And it was all the stats and like just kind of like unanswered things. And like, so we were until literally her reception cut out. Literally until the reception cut out. Like, and that was like, at that point, I was like, there is nothing I can't do for this book because this person did this for, like, there is no, like, I can't say no to anything at this point. Like,
you're invested, right? You're both invested. Yeah, it becomes a partnership, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it becomes a true hugely partnership,
so,
for sure.
Hugely so. Like, it was, and it was like, I was, in the moment, well aware of, like, this is not something you hear about happening all the time. And even
not anymore.
The 60s and 70s, it would not have been, like, it is. You know, it is not a thing that you would have heard about happening even, you know, like I had this thought, like, who are you, Philip Roth? Like the, like, or like some kind of like, who are you? The, you know, that kind of moment of like, how did this become my life and this book's life and stuff. But it was, she had the faith, like she really kept the faith on it. And she knew, like she had a real sense of like, no. It's going to be this thing. And I think it bore out in terms of, as you mentioned, like the real sort of step change or like league change, I guess.
In the work.
But it took a lot of doing other projects, frankly, doing other smaller projects for other clients. Or for clients, doing client work, doing short-term work, doing very tight, very strict work, and then getting the freedom to do other stuff. Like that had taught me the moderation.
Oh, that's great. I have to ask, because I thought about this right as I got to the end of the book. Did the genre gothic ever get thrown around?
It's funny because like
I think we did talk about it because
we talked about the house as a haunted house.
Yes.
And that was the thing that Cory Doctorow in his review like latched onto right away. And I did an event in Los Angeles at Chevalier with Cory, and that was like one of the first things that he asked about was like, this is a haunted house. Like, you've written a haunted house book. And I was like, well, I've always wanted to do that. And to my mind, I still haven't entirely done that. But the one thing that happened, one of the jobs that I did was very early on in my Foresight career was write a short story called Social Services for the Institute for the Future for an anthology called An Aura of Familiarity, The Coming Age of Networked Matter. And it was about smart homes and like smart materials and smart, like what would be possible, like when compute sort of moves to zero, the way Brian David Johnson sort of puts it, like, you know, what would happen when everything around you was alive. And, you know, to me, the idea of everything around you being alive is not a science fiction idea. That's a fairy tale idea. That's a Shinto idea. That's a certain religions hold with that idea. There are that is we have early cinematic depictions of that. The one that I thought of immediately was La Belle et la Bête, which is Cocteau's Beauty and the Beast, where everything in the house is alive, and the way that he tells you that is that there are candelabras ex and sconces and torches extended from the walls held by human hands. And so there's a wall, there's like the set, and in the set, in the seams between, like, I think hanging scrims or silks or something like that, human hands extend out and they're holding, you know, torches. And they do, like, they pop up out of the table and they do all these different things, and all it is hands, but everything in the house is alive. And at that moment, I thinking about stuff like that, I was like, oh, that's the dream. Like, that's the dream of power. Like, the dream of power is not to have a technology. The dream of power is to have more power. That's power for power's sake, right? And our earliest depictions of that are not accessing that through the gift of fire or what have you. It's just having it. And it's having things to our command. And that is a fairy tale idea, and that is a magic idea and a more creepy idea. And that sort of got into how I wrote that particular story, which when I read that anthology for when I read all the other stories in the anthology for from IFTF, we'd all written almost with like down to the almost down to the last one. I think there were maybe like one or two outliers. We had all written haunted house stories and go or ghost stories, right? And so that had always stuck with me, that like, oh no, there's a real core, there's something else in here that has nothing to do with how the technology works. In fact, the less you see of how it works, the more gothic it gets, right? Because to be gothic is to have a secret. Like, the gothic is about a secret, about a thing that is repressed and comes back in an altered form that is more horrific because you didn't deal with it in the moment. And I'd done, like, in grad school, I had done like a class on the Gothic, which was actually like my favorite class. And then VN had actually, my first novel had actually been taught in a course on the Gothic at Swansea. That it was, she started with like, it was very sweet. Like, they started with Frankenstein, then ended with VN, which I thought was like, you know, yeah, I was like, great, I can die now. Wonderful. Like, I was like, fantastic. I can be run over by a bus tomorrow. Amazing. Like, life goals achieved, done. And so it that had always been on my mind, and that was the thing that Miriam and I did agree on straight away, was that no matter what else it was going to have this, like, nope, this is about secrets, this is about things which are hidden, this is about unreliability, this is about all the things that technology also serves to hide from us, right? I thought that was sort of what was on my mind. And then the other thing that stuck around, draft to draft to draft, regardless of genre, regardless of plot events, regardless of, like, the ending, which changed like so many times. So many times.
I was wondering how you were going to pull it out. I was getting to the end going, shit, how's she?
How's she going to do this? This, when is she going to pull the shoot? When is she? When will she pull the shoot? When? When will she pull the eject button? No matter what changed, the thing that got to stay was the humor, the jokes, and that
but
is
you need yeah. For that. Oh, yeah. God, Jesus,
oh,
that
man,
you need that emotional release. Yeah,
without
I was actually. Yeah,
it would not work. Like without it, the book
it's
would
too
not
tense
work.
Already. It's already it's like I so... can feel it. Right, again, women in tech. Right, you can feel it in your guts as you're reading it. And
there
it,
are
like I have to, yeah, put it down sometimes.
I think it was Cat Howard, and I think I mentioned this in the conference. Yeah. The Cat started it, and she's and I think it was like kind of at the beginning of lockdown or something. She's like, I can't do it. I can't do it right now. I'm sorry, but I can't. And I'm like, no, that's good. That actually is like a good note. Like I'm actually very one, I've done my job. And two, that is actually a thing to keep in mind. And so I thought a lot about like keeping the humor, because that also was her voice. That was another thing that like in Company Town people really latched onto, was that because the protagonist of that novel is a Newfoundlander, she has a really Newfoundland kind of sense of humor. And which is a very distinct, very Irish, Scottish inflected kind of sense of humor. And that is also very true in Ontario. So the protagonist of this book, Kristen Howard, I named her after Kat, is from Northern Ontario or grew up in Northern Ontario. And so whenever I thought that she was being too sharp or mean or like snide or like nasty or whatever, I would go and watch like an episode of Letterkenny. and then I'm like, if Dwayne wouldn't say it, then you can't say it, but if Dwayne would say it, you're good. And like, or McMurray, if McMurray wouldn't say it, because like McMurray and Mrs. McMurray are just so foul. But that is like, Letterkenny is a beautifully written show. Like it is so well crafted and the language in it is just so beautiful and so like it is just a delight. And I wanted her to have that real cadence to her speech and that real like very Northern Ontario, very Canadian, very like, you know, this is a country that will kill you if you go outside kind of vibe to her, where there's just, how do you navigate the cruelty of the landscape and your history? Mm, right.
Yeah.
And it's not by being very cuddly, I guess.
Oh shit. Well, I have tons of questions and I could talk to you all day, but to be respectful of time.
No, you can ask me more. I'm good.
Yeah, no, it's good. Well, first, Tim, did you have any questions?
I had one follow-up question.
Yeah.
When you mentioned about your editor saying it's not quite ready and you going back, are you doing like popping into a chapter, rewriting a chapter? Or are you talking about like page one, starting over? Like what's that process like?
Oh. I don't do like the copy, I don't duplicate the documents. I'm a real kind of like no net, high wire, no net person. Like I don't really do that. Or I try not to, like I might, like one, it's more executive function drain for me. Like, what are we doing? You know, are we sort of, sorry. What are we doing in terms of like how many damn files do I really need to solve this problem? And then also, if I don't feel like I don't want to be so precious about it, I guess, and I don't want to. If I like, not to be like, if I remember it, then it was important, which is like a fallacy that like, I think lots of people fall into, but also like, if I, What does he say in Gattaca? Like, I didn't save anything for the swim back.
The swim back,
Yeah,
yeah,
for the swim
best
back.
line,
Like the yeah.
didn't say,
And
yeah,
so,
oof.
and it is that. It's like if you
You're
always,
ruthless,
yeah,
ruthless,
if you, well, no, but it's like if you, because like one sh is the other draft there? Yeah, it's in the email that sent it. Could I find it again? Yeah, sure, I could. I could do that. But if it's in there in Scrivener, sitting in a, like, I might put it in a trash pile, but not label it often. And that I will often do, or I'll segment the parts that I'm cutting and put it in the notes tab of Scrivener, not in any particular order. So I don't necessarily know like where it fit in. Like if there's a turn of phrase, or crucially, like more crucially, like a piece of information that I exposited, that's the real, like, we have to save that. But I try not to be like, I try not to leave myself a lot of escape routes, because I also believe it, or it has been my experience, that your brain will do that. Because I describe it as the IKEA theory of writing, that your first draft is like going through an IKEA, where you go through the showroom. When you go through the IKEA showroom, you go very slowly. You go through every room. You pick up objects. You see if they fit. You see if, you want them. Like, does this fit? Does this fit? I don't know. Would this? Let's make a list. Da, da, da. And you're there all day. You're just there. The second time, once you know what you want, you move a little faster. You know which room you should go to pick up the thing that you need. You know kind of like what might fit. You go there. You move a lot faster. That third time through is when you discover all the secret passages in IKEA, and that you could have gotten from space to space much faster.
Yeah,
And
that's
you
really
did
good.
it there. You did it because you did it this way because you didn't know yet, but that it had always been there. The way to get through had always been there. The passage had always existed, and you had left it behind yourself the first time you went through. And then the copy edits and the cleanup edits are essentially like going into the warehouse with the number and saying like, no, we need this instead. I need this washer, or I need this, I need this cushion in this color. This is the SKU number. Get it for me. It is as impersonal as that. Or should be by that stage, like, to so that you get it done. Like, that is not the time for the big existential questions necessarily. But I do find that, like, every time I've edited, gone through a book, there's always been this moment of like, oh, that's why I did that. And that's the, I think of that now as like the IKEA moment where you turn, and instead of like pointing your head, like looking straight ahead, you look to the side and you're like, oh, wait, I could have gotten from here to here, like this, not all the way around.
And this is a key thing, and I struggle with it because be more productive. We all need to do a book a year. Ha ha ha. But it's like the process of going through that, though, you
Yes.
don't know what rooms, right, that you need to go through, or because you don't know what items are in there and you don't know what you're going to need. So you
No,
can't
yeah.
take the shortcut. It's
No,
impossible. Even if you saw it, you couldn't see it. Because you have to go through the whole room first,
yeah,
right?
you have to
And
figure
that's
out what
how, yeah,
doesn't,
I definitely feel those feels. Yeah.
you have to, what do they say in like in business and design school, they tell you like fail faster. Like, which is the way I think about like the writing a, and we tell young writers this too, or I try not to say young, I say beginning writers, like new writers. We tell them like, no, just submit everything. Doesn't matter. Like, who cares? Just start the pile of rejection letters. Just do it. And that comes from that sort of fail faster model, so that you learn what doesn't work. But you also have to do that on long-term projects. You also have to fail faster in a long-term project and see what doesn't work. But on a longer-term project, the stakes are higher and it's more painful. so it takes longer. And so you can really get yourself lost in the wilderness. Like, I sort of liken it, every book that I do, and I think other people are like this too, but I don't want to speak for them, but it's like, every book is like a sort of diary of the obsessions and interests that you were into at the time, mm-hmm. right? In the same 100%. Way that like writing a master's thesis or a dissertation or like a MFA or whatever is about like, nope, this was a thing that exists in time and it's about what I knew at the time and what I was interested in. And like, it is the sum total of something from a time period in my life, in history, whatever. And that is true, I think, of novels, but the longer you take with them, the more you will feel the need to pack in, which was my other problem. Like, I just, the more I waited, the longer I took. One, I got scooped by actual history. That happened a lot, where it's like, oh, well, shit, now this is libelous. I can't do it. Or I would feel this like need to show everybody that I'd done my homework. Yeah. Right. And that is also like not a thing. There are readers who do care about that. They are a vanishingly small percentage of the total body of readers everywhere. And also, if you have an afterword, that's what that's for.
What it's for, exactly. No, I was in our reading list. Yeah, I'm like, oh shit, this is great. Yeah,
you know, and it's also like a place to shine light on other people's work.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why, like, you know, you can redirect that attention. Then, like, you know, that's one of the things I realized I could do with that. And people have gotten in touch with me, like, not realizing that they were in the acknowledgement, saying like, oh my god, thank you, and stuff, which was really lovely. People have also gotten back saying that they read it all in one night, and I'm like, wow.
That's a baller. Like I said, I had to put it down.
No, I'm glad you did. No, yeah. Because like, it takes you as many years to finish it. It's like,
don't read it in an hour, goddamn.
No, I want people to do that, because those are actually some of my favorite reading experiences. Like, that's when I know. Because, I mean, like, the other thing is, part of when you provide an experience to readers is that you are giving them a moment inside their own head. Mm-hmm. You are creating for them an experience in which they are alone inside their own mind with you, or with you, what you did, what you made. But they are alone inside their own mind in a way that being with other people, reading something online, looking at their phone, looking at a screen, even being out with other people, like, you know, they are not that. In the same way that they are reading a book, ideally a paper one. Because that is the only time, barring, you know, book bans or, you know, where you purchase the book or you know, censorship laws or what have you, that is the only time that you are not being watched back. The book isn't reading you back if it's a paper book or a paper newspaper or a paper magazine. It is not reading you back. There is no eye tracking. There is no, you know, keystroke logging. There is no judgment of how long you stayed on a page. There is none of that. And it is where you are unsurveilled, where you are not surveilled, and where you are alone inside your own head. And that is where you discover who you are. And that to me is sort of a sacred trust. So if I can do a thing that gives people a solid multi-hour block where they have that, that is very special to me.
I'm ruminating on your IKEA thing. And now I'm wondering if the as-is section is like where all the leftover parts of the book
yes. Yeah. Reside. It's like, this is where this, that the as-is is like, you know, future book ideas. That's where future the book next ideas thing comes in. Like that. It's like, look, we could fix this. If I also had some thinking, wood, like, glue and, you know, varnish, I got some Mod Podge, yep, and some, you know, fun stuff. But I think it is, I think, or like the discontinued, like, it's mm-hmm. fascinating to me that IKEA like has IKEA is like a wonderful, like, they're so interesting as a company. Their corporate history is so interesting. And like their vision is really interesting. And I worked for some people who did a project with them, and like, that was just like they were actually interested in pure research. It was really amazing. Like I think that they are one of the reasons that they are interesting is that they keep like a design catalog of all the designs from decades ago, and they will discontinue but also bring things back. And it's because there's sort of a long-term vision of like, this doesn't work right now, but it's gonna.
Yeah, it's that cyclical
idea. Yeah, like this isn't working right now, but it's going to. And I think that was also that tied in with this, like, because there were many times writing this where I was like, oh, Silicon Valley is out. Oh, the Circle is out. Oh, devs is out. Oh, the imposter, or like, or imposter syndrome, or like other novels, like self-care novel, or like The Startup Wife, or like other books that were like very similar to this one. There's a Ruth Ware novel that is like also kind of an And Then There Were None structured book that I am blanking at the retreat, but it's set in the Swiss Alps, I think. And or it's set on a ski lodge. And so there, every time that happened, I would get like very demoralized. And I think it might have been Miriam, I can't remember, but she was like, whenever it comes out, people will still be angry about this. That ain't like it's not gonna go away. Yeah. It's not a limited edition item. Yeah. Like it is that anger, that need for catharsis,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Doesn't dry up necessarily. It might dry up for the individual, you know, depending on their circumstances. But for the public, it's, you know, for the reading community, for people who read, you know, that doesn't, you know, get fully tapped. They might get more interested in other stuff, but that desire doesn't go away. And I think, like, in a weird way, it came out exactly at the right time. I think
exactly what I needed to come out.
Yeah, exactly. Like there were a lot of moments where I was like, oh, okay, like maybe it's good it's coming out in election year. Okay.
Well, sure. You gotta get also, because I know you're like, we always think, oh, and that book did it like this and this, but the other. But there, it's an in a conversation, right? And to me, it's, yes, like then you become the next book that's read after that, or they become the next book that's read after yours, or because it's a conversation, and that's,
yes,
to me, that builds. The more people are doing, start having that conversation, the more you can, you know, it's awareness and more
community. Yeah, it's more fulsome. Right? It's definitely, yeah, like a more fulsome, more well-rounded conversation. You are more likely to represent more points of view, if you get that out there. Like if you are getting more people writing on that same subject, and there were definitely, like, there were other books that I read and other books that I knew about in regard to this, that were similar subject matter, but also like there were some that I didn't like. Chelsea Summers, this big beautiful cannibal book, Chelsea G. Summers, The Hunger or something like that, and I'm blanking on it. I apologize, Chelsea, if you're listening. I'm sorry. But everybody read it. Certain Hungers. Certain Hungers. Like, very, like, was very helpful. Like, reading, looking at how, like, a lot of Dashiell Hammett, like, now that he's in, especially now that everybody should go read Red Harvest now that it's in the public domain, go read that. You know, things that were light, that were trim, certainly like some of the Ripley novels, like Ripley's Game and like The Boy Who Followed Ripley and like stuff like that. I'd always been a fan of Agatha Christie and those types of books, like from when I was a child, like from when I was like in grade two. And I'd always been a fan of Sebastian Japrzo's work, and he's like a very like psychosexual gothic French detective writer. thriller detective story writer and stuff, which is like in keeping with the French tradition, like Diablo League, like the novel that inspired Vertigo was written by two French writers, I think. So like there's, and I had always been like a giant Hitchcock fan as well. Also from when I was like a very, very tiny child and could not read. I had been into the films of Alfred Hitchcock for, I don't know, because I was very ill as a kid. And so those just sort of got baked in, I guess.
Well, and related, Tim, I think we're ready for our final question here.
Oh, yeah. It's time for our pop culture pop quiz. Speaking of Alfred Hitchcock, where we talk about what you've been reading, what you've been watching, what you've been listening to, those sorts of things in your life, Madeline.
Let's see. So, unfortunately, like I know two writers who died recently, Nicholas Nova and Andrew Piper, and I'm just going to recommend their work. So, Nicholas Nova wrote, he's also a futurist, and he did a huge, like, the he wrote about design fiction, and he had a book that just came out. In fact, I'm just going to quickly type up. I want to make sure that I get the title absolutely perfectly right. My gosh, I'm looking through
his actual thing.
There's so much here, but he wrote a great deal about design fiction and about foresight and about technology, field studies in design fiction, from field research to design fiction, from clarifying the present to designing the future. He wrote a great deal about our relationship to technology, and he also wrote in French. He also, like, so if you read him, you can read him in French and English. And also Andrew Piper, who died right almost at exactly the same time, in a very spooky way, who had just written, I think it's not his most recent, but it's the one that is jumping to mind, because he's a very good writer. He's a Canadian horror writer, or was a Canadian horror writer, and was The Picture of Health, and unfortunately died of cancer or complications related to cancer recently. And he was just the most, like, he could do a hook like you wouldn't believe. Like, he wrote, I believe it's called The Residence, which is the haunting of the White House as told by the Lincolns. And you're like, what? I'm so in. Like, it's like, I remember hearing it, I was like, you son of a bitch. Like, like I'm in, you sold me. Like, and also he was the nicest man. Like, he was just so nice. Like, when we first met, probably like 10 years ago, it was when my husband and I were first together before we were married. And so it might've been over 10 years ago. And we met at a Canadian literary event. It might've been Word on the Street. It might've been a reading series. But I thought that because my husband, David Nichol, is also a horror writer, I thought that they would sort of have more to talk about. And then immediately Piper was like, tell me about your book. And I, because it must have been around when VN was coming out or when it had just been sold. And I told him, and then he remembered my name and asked me what I was doing every time we met thereafter. And it really was like one of those things of, I did not expect my work to make an impression on this person, but they took the time to remember. And as a person who is like terrible at that, I really appreciated it. And it's those things, the quote about like people will remember how you feel, how you made them feel. That is absolutely the case. And both Nick and Piper were so good at that. They were just such, this is going to sound like very cheesy because of the thing that I'll name check later, but they were just such gentlemen. They were both just such gentlemen.
And now you're going to mention The Gentleman on Netflix.
Yeah, I am. I am going to mention The Gentleman on Netflix. Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Tim.
What a segue.
Thank you for taking us there. Thank you for taking us there. Yes. Yes. No, that became my favorite thing after the death of my cat, Claudius.
Mm.
Claudius died February 1st. And that show came out in March. And we were trying to, like, our other cat Hecate was so listless, like she would literally sort of lie on her outstretched arm like this, because her life mate essentially had been taken. She was sort of Penelope weaving and unweaving the fabric of our chairs. And so we tried to get another cat to, like, you know, put some life back into her. And he's a wonderful cat, but he was absolutely the wrong choice because he was quite aggressive. And so there were whole days where, like, I could not leave a room. I could not leave the bedroom. I had to be with this cat. Because otherwise he would just literally start throwing himself at the door, and like it was very psychically painful for everybody. And then there was this show, which was Guy Ritchie and Matthew Reed, or Matthew Red, and is just beautifully written and like has a real flair for language. Again, kind of like Letterkenny, like it actually has like a very Letterkenny-ish mm-hmm. flavor to it. It's just about far wealthier people, and but it's got a similar kind of irreverence and is also about a family that also sort of teases each other in much the same way that, like, you know, Dwayne and Katie's family tease each other on Letterkenny. Letterkenny, I will also recommend. I think Letterkenny is secretly a gothic show. You want a thing that's secretly a gothic show? I firmly believe. One, I will tell. I told this to a cab driver or a driver in San Diego, and he played like, you know, pickup hockey or whatever, beer league hockey, with a lot of actual pro players who keep up their skills in the off season when they, like, who live in California and have to, like, keep skating. And I told him this theory and he bought it. One, I believe that Dwayne and Katie killed their parents. I believe that Dwayne and Katie killed their parents. Because, like, Dwayne's whole thing is that he cannot tolerate cheating in any way, shape, or form. It destroys relationships. He, like, won't go for it. And two, we know that in that community, for a time before he went on to Sudbury, was a guy who looks exactly like Wayne, because he's played by the same actor. But a guy who looks exactly like Wayne, who everybody hates, by the name of Shorzy. And Shorzy is really great at, even better at insulting people than Wayne is. And at one point, Wayne goes and helps, like, Shorzy in a fight and watches him skate, just sits there and watches him skate in the barn, at the rink. And then shortly after that is when Shorzy leaves town. And so I've always thought that the secret history of Letterkenny is that Dwayne probably killed their parents, dad for cheating on mom or something like that, and then she died, you know, of shame. I don't know. And it's canlit. You can die of shame. You know, there's a piece in The All about that. Like, I think Daniel Lavery did, like, a beautiful, like, how do you know it's canlit? And it's because, like, it's about all the cod being gone or whatever. Like, it's a fantastic piece. Everybody should go find it. I think it's The All or The Toast, and it's about how do you know it's canlit. And it's, I used to make a joke about VN, or about the Machine Dynasty trilogy, that you knew it was CanCon or canlit because it's about three generations of women solving the same problem, and the problem is humans. And so that was. But that's my deep, dark theory about Letterkenny, so I'm going to say that. So The Gentleman and Letterkenny, which linguistically are very much the same, although about different subject matters. And then watching, like, so that's what I've been watching. That and the Criterion Channel, I recommend that to everybody. Listening to a lot of, like, white noise and things like that. We actually, like, spent some time listening over Christmas. We listened to a lot of, like, medieval Christmas stuff. So next year I would sort of recommend that to people, is go find interest, like, really interesting sort of medieval Christmas things. And I mention that because there are medieval Christmas songs on the soundtrack to Nosferatu, which we also saw recently. And so it was really interesting to hear like some of the songs that we had just been hearing at home, it, you know, in this, you know, as a repeat motif in this thing. And so it was, that was kind of unsettling in addition to like the larger unsettledness of the story. When you're married to a horror writer, you see every Dracula telling that that exists. So like this was basically the Whitman sampler of all of them. It was the like the supercut or the sizzle reel of all of the Dracula and vampire stories. Like it's a remake of Nosferatu the film, but like it's also the ne plus ultra of all vampire stories in one thing. And so it was very interesting to like sort of watch it like, oh well, like everything, you hit every mark, really. Like you knew where every mark was and then you hit it. And
it really is.
It's like we've hit every beat. We've hit every beat and stuff. And that is actually like having done, you know, I think that's the value of doing a solid genre piece is like you learn to hit those marks. Like if you're trying to entertain a crowd, if you're asking people to perform at like, you know, the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, you do not get interpretive dancers. You get the Rockettes. You get people who can kick in a line, who can hit their marks, who can go there. And it's not that they're incapable of the other thing. It's that being on their marks is what gives them the strength and the reliability to do the other stuff, I think. And that's what I think, certainly around writing about, I did a piece in 2023 about the SAG strikes and the WGA strikes, and that was what I really got a sense of in talking with members of WGA in particular and other like IATSE and stuff like that, was that it is doing that work that makes you great at the more abstract, at the more esoteric, at the more challenging stuff, is doing the, you know, the people who, one thing that came out a lot in writing that piece was that because streaming has upended the system so much, and because seasons as we think of them are so much shorter, we don't actually give filmmakers and anybody in production, whether it's actors or makeup or set design or production design or lighting or sound or anybody, enough time to learn. We don't actually give them 22 episodes a season to learn. We are not doing our journeyman work. Like we aren't giving people the opportunity to be journeymen or to be apprentices or to be learners. And we're turning it into a sort, or we have turned it into an all or nothing zero sum game, which is very,
publishing.
Very
publishing's
yeah.
the same, right?
And publishing is the same.
You used to be able to be a house writer. That's how we got amazing books, is that you knew you could turn in, you know, six books of you figuring it out and then you'd hit, right? Because you had that luxury now, but of doing that, but that's how you come up in the business. And again, short story markets, right? The death of the short story markets and all of that is, so instead we're getting these poor 25, 26 year old kids, but young adults
who
are
people
given,
are just starting
here's your 150,000. Oh, your book sucked and it tanked and we're done with you now. Right.
No, so it's
like this all or nothing. And everyone thinks it's all or nothing. But in fact, like it was that journeyman process. So you can get your level up. You know?
And it's really sad in that we're treating, you know, and we shouldn't do this to them either, but it's really like it is treating art production or art or the act of creation in whatever medium the way that we treat pro athletics, that it's like we're going to grab you out of college and we're going to work you till you drop or you get injured or you get something happens to you or whatever. We're going to pay you. You know, if you're very lucky, we're going to pay you all this money. If you're not, we're going to like make sure you stay alive until you get hurt. And then it's over. And by the way, I hope that you have a degree in something else. Or have been, you know, or can in some other way explain this massive gap in your resume or whatever. You know, what were you doing? I was writing books. But that system for athletes as well. I mean, like the reason that there was such a push to create unions and create good solid rules around college athletics was to prevent exactly this, right? To create some protection for those learners, because they are also learning, their brains are developing, their bodies are still, like, in many ways, like, you know, they are not done yet. And they may also, they should also have the room to change their mind. You know, the thing that'll convince you not to be a writer is trying to write a book. Right? Like, it's like, oh, I always thought I could do that. You should see if you can.
I forgot how hard it was. It had been 4 years, 5 years, and I just finished, last year. And I went, that was really fucking hard. How was I doing that?
What
I don't
was
even
I
know.
Doing? How did I do this? How was I not? And it is a thing of, like, it is much easier. I started writing probably when I was a teenager. And I'd always, from when I could speak, I was always telling stories because I was a only child and very lonely, and or not lonely, lonely, loneliness presumes that you know what it's like to not be alone. But so I was alone all the time. And so I always recited my stories to myself, and like I would do funny voices. And so I, again, that cadence thing, right? And then when I finally started to learn how to like write and type, then I would do it more. And then in grade 9, I turned in an assignment early in the year that was supposed to be like a 10 or 15 page story. And I turned in like a 35 page document. And my teacher, who was a Fulbright scholar stranded in Western Washington, said, you clearly have something here, that why don't we do a thing where for every unit I teach, you can turn in a chapter, and I will give you an A for the year and not ask you to do any other homework. In exchange, you have to submit this for publication when it's done. And that was like the first book I ever wrote, was when I was like 14 or 15 years old. And so after that, whenever I'm right, I'm chasing how that felt.
Yeah.
And I think that's a lot of people, right? Is like,
the A.
The flow, right? Like, does this feel like it did when I was a kid?
Mm-hmm. Like, that joy, or
yeah, like the joy, the flow state, the focus, the excitement, is it the first thing I think about when I wake up? Is it the last thing I think about when I go to sleep? Because that's usually when I know that I'm in a book, like in something. It's like, is it the first thing I think about when I wake up? And the last thing, am I still writing the other scene? Haruki Murakami, I think, in what we talk about when we talk about running, says something like he will often stop writing for the day mid-sentence so that he knows exactly where he's supposed to, like, go from. He tries not to end on a finished scene because that's much harder to get to start back from. But mid-sentence is like, you're in the momentum, which again goes back to that running metaphor of like, this is a physical process. You have to be in the chair or standing or in a hammock. I don't know. But I wouldn't recommend that. That's probably very bad for spinal health. But that's what I always want, does it feel like I did when I didn't know what failing was?
Yeah.
Right. And I think that's what, I think that's the thing that people chase all the time, whether it's art, athletics, relationships, anything, you know, does it feel like I did when, before I knew how wrong it could go? Before I knew anything. Yeah. Well, can we achieve some sort of state of innocence or grace, or some sort of state of, you know, hope, or some sort of state, yes, of where we are, can we come back to the place where we were, if this was ever the case, of having been insulated or protected in some way? Like, are we, you know, and that I think is, in doing the work, like, very important. And I think that's what people access when they read. I think that a lot of people, like, when they start reading again, I notice when I've flown around doing consulting work, people tell me, oh, I used to be a reader. I used to read so much. And then this. And women in particular, and women in science fiction in particular, the stats do not lie. Women stop, like, they stop reading science fiction right around the time that they, like, stop being good at math or stop being good at science or whatever. Like, I would, again and again and again, I heard this, like, oh, in junior high, I stopped. And it's like, yeah, because you weren't supposed to, or you were told to read other things that were about how you should look, or, like, other different stuff, or, like, whatever. And those things are not bad. It's that you were accessing something, and then that access got cut off. And then you find out that a lot of those women, like, come back to it at 40 when they're pregnant, you know, in moments of rupture. You know, there's a lot of before and after moments that people come to reading with. And one of the things I'm always, like, really conscious of is the fact that your work might be with people at the worst moment of their lives. Like, people read a lot in hospital waiting rooms. And I'm always super aware of that. There's a reason they put the books in the airport. And it's not just that you're locked in there. It's because you might be on your way somewhere that you don't want to be.
Speaking of that, I will recommend one thing, and it's a book I've been telling everyone to read, which is Hope for Cynics. It is, it's the perfect one for this time, right?
For the beginning of the year, 2024.
So it's Hope for Cynics. Just a really, it literally is written by a cynic about why we should be more hopeful, and it's got the data to back it up, and studies and stuff. And as a cynic, you know, who's kind of, I realize that I am a grim optimist. So, and I think those are the same thing. It's like a realist or hopeful cynic. Yeah.
I think there's a question. I wrote a lot about romance for Wired. I wrote a couple of pieces about category romance and, like, for Wired. And the thing I landed on both times, like, in talking to a lot of romance writers, was that, like, it is a fundamentally optimistic genre because it believes in the human capacity for change. All romance hinges on, like, does Darcy pull his head out of his ass, essentially? Does, you know, can Rochester ever atone? Can, you know, like, will this person run after the other at the airport? Like, blah, 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 blah. All those different things. And you know, or can you learn to accept love? Can you be in acceptance of that? And it starts there, like, for all the other changes that we as a society have to make. Like, if you don't believe that other people are capable of change, you're going to always do it from this sort of, like, back foot posture, right? Or you're always going to do it with a lot of suspicion and possibly from a bad faith position if you don't believe that that's possible.
All right, Madeline, it has been goddamn joy. Jesus.
Wait, Christ.
Invite me
back. Oh, wait, sorry. Oh, Tim, what do you have?
Black Doves.
Oh, Black Doves.
On Netflix. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of fun. Keira Knightley is fantastic.
She's wonderful.
And Ben Whishaw is great, too.
I just saw a thing that I wish more people had watched when it came out, because, God, it is, like, even better the second time, especially now. Like, I think it came out 2021 or 2022, and watching it on the cusp of 2025 was, like, a whole other experience. It was Keira Knightley in, it's also a Marv Films production. It's Keira Knightley in Silent Night, which is a purports to be, it's got Annabelle Wallace is in it, the lady from Yellowstone. Matthew Good is in it as well. And it purports to be about a group of, like, college friends, Big Chill style, getting back to celebrate the holidays together. And then it's about something very different and very poignant. And it's just lovely. Like, also Lily Rose Depp is in it. Also, I totally forgot that she was in it. And it was like, I saw it right before I saw Nosferatu. So it was really interesting to watch that change. And man, is it like, it's not a rough watch at all. It's actually quite comforting in a weird way, but if you like Keira Knightley, like finally being allowed to do sort of more, I'm gonna say grown up, but like more, to show more range, frankly, to show more range. That is your next fun thing, or a thing for next year, like next season. You know, yeah. I'm always a, you know, which are the alternative Christmas movies that aren't Die Hard? What are the, you know, what is out there? That, like, I'm a devoted Bob Clark Black Christmas fan.
That for the first time this year. Yeah.
That's made in Canada.
Shit, that's where that saying comes from. It's coming from inside the house.
Coming from inside the house. Yeah. No, and that's Bob. So I'm going to see if I can, like, blow your mind here. I hope that some people still know this, but so Bob Clark, who made Black Christmas, which is about sorority students being terrorized in their sorority house, which is filmed in Canada, and there's Canadian accents all over it. He made Black Christmas in 1974, and then years later, he went on to make A Christmas Story. Same guy. Same dude.
That's hilarious.
He owns the two, the North and South Poles. he has Father Christmas on one side and Krampus on the other. Like, that is his, that is nice. Him. That is Bob Clark.
Oh, that's great.
And in between is Porky's.
Well, speaking of Canada, the book that I have been reading, is called This Is Your Life.
Yeah.
They're like one of my top three bands of all time.
Yes.
And this is basically their entire history in pictures and words, chronologically told. It's I'm just barely starting it. It's so thick, and it's just got so much information in it. And one of the great Canadian bands that are criminally underappreciated in the United States. Mm-hmm. Anybody who's a music fan would probably like to check that out, or the documentary that was on that's on Amazon, No Dress Rehearsal. It's a four-part series, which is fantastic. Clearly the nicest band you have ever seen represented, like their moms and dads drove them to practice, like that kind of thing. Like, there was no drug issues, there was no, like, you know, I mean there was some, obviously, some tensions as they grow up and get old, and now we're having kids, so when do we practice and that sort of thing. But like, it was the most uncomplicated band in history, probably, to be that successful. So definitely worth checking out if you're a fan of music and stuff, want to check that out. So that's it. Cameron.
Okay. I can't wrap it very well. I just want to say, Madeline, that was amazing. And we really need to talk more.
We should set up a regular thing. I will come regularly. You can, do it for your patrons or whatever. We'll do a thing.
That if
you
want a regular,
then I would actually talk to people more.
My husband is also trying to get me to talk to people more, so I feel like
my therapist would be so proud. I will happily come on whenever. We can set up a regular thing. I don't, you have like a, like, I would do more. I think meeting with people is such an executive function challenge. If it doesn't happen on a regular basis, I won't do it.
It's hard.
And stuff. So yeah, like, we should set up like a regular, whether just us or if you want to record it, we can do that too. But yeah, let's do it. I would happily come on.
Awesome. Well, thank you, ma'am. Everybody out, go, please go and read Glass Houses. It will devastate you. It will devastate you.
Yeah. And tell, if you've read it, tell me. If you're in tech and you read it, let me know. Like, yeah. I definitely,
she would love to hear from you.
I would love to hear from you. Hopefully I will not sob for 10 solid minutes this time, you know, building my resistance.
I'm going to mention that people should go to madelineashby.com where they can check out all of your works and links and various things, and can follow you on Blue Sky.
Yeah, Blue Sky is probably the one. Like, I mean, certainly I'm no fan of Zuckerberg right now.
Can't imagine why.
Yeah, no. I don't know. I think we should start watching for some Architectural Digest with that dude. I think that dude's going to sell a property in California very soon.
Yeah, that he's getting a divorce.
Yep.
Yeah, that's what people are saying.
That you know, that gold,
big divorce that fan
gold,
energy.
Gold chain and Costco sweatshirt don't lie. I mean, it's just like, buddy. And I know, I actually looked into the gold medallion, and it is like actually a very sweet story, and it's definitely the kind of thing that you would tell people if they asked you about it.
Okay. I don't know how to transition out of that. Cameron is at CameronHurley.com on Blue Sky under her name. If you are listening to this, you can watch the video and more exclusively at patreon.com/ Cameron Hurley. You can join Hurley's Heroes to get short, gooey adventures from Cameron every month. We've literally got, I don't know, 8 dozen stories, I think, there.
A lot. Cameron.
And by gooey, we mean, like...
Gooey.
So those are her words.
Cronenbergian.
Yes, Cronenbergian. Oh, yeah, real good. Yeah, literally gooey.
Okay.
Yes, not like... For any
sexually
other
gooey.
I was like, wow.
No, like squish a bug gooey.
A real turn in her career, yeah.
Yes. Cameron, send us home.
All right, everyone listening, it's time to get back to work.